As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the weekend preview on the Athletic Football Podcast, sponsored by Bet365. I'm Dan Bardell with my co-host George Ellick and Bet365 Steve Freith alongside me as ever to preview the best of the weekend's Premier League action, which includes Arsenal v Manchester United, a Merseyside derby and a little bit more as well. Before we do get into the Premier League action, though, we're going to start on a bit of a sombre note after the terrible news of Nigel Pearson's passing this week. Steve, he was a good friend of yours, I understand, and a respected colleague, worked for so many different companies, respected by so many, loved by so many. A tragic loss.
Yeah, very much so, Dan. I think the outpouring of grief that we've seen this week and the tributes to him just say a lot about the man that he was. You know, I was discussing my 50th birthday with him, and he was sending me pictures of a pint of Guinness with big thumbs up and everything like that. Looking forward to it, pal. He always called everyone pal. You know, and you'd see him do the rounds in the press room, be sitting next to everybody, laughing and smiling. He'd come next to me, we'd have a pie. I might even have two, to be honest with you. And then we'd go upstairs and sit on the gantry next to him when he was working for TalkSport. And he'd always make a poor Albion showing. Very bearable, to be honest. He, like a lot of people have already said, he always had a smile on his face. He put a smile on people's faces as well. You know, a knowledgeable man, Dan, as you've mentioned, over a lot of sports, a big family man as well. He will be sorely missed by a lot of people.
Yeah, I didn't know him personally, but everyone who works in the media knows his voice and they know who he is. And everyone that I've seen has had nothing but nice words to say about him. So yeah, condolences to his family and friends. And yeah, a tragic, tragic loss. Nigel Pearson. Game one of the weekend that we're going to look at is Arsenal v Manchester United. Lunchtime kickoff, of course. Let's start with United, George. 4-0 losers at Anfield on Tuesday evening. I mean, they've had a few low moments in recent years, but did that first half feel like rock bottom? No surprise they've quickly moved to announce Erik ten Hag's appointment in the last 24 hours. He's got a big, big, big job on his hands.
He does, yeah. I guess in some ways for Ten Hag, taking over at rock bottom isn't the worst thing. He's got a bit of a blank canvas to work with. I think expectations are now incredibly low as in terms of where this squad is at the moment without a big overhaul. It's worth pointing out that I think in 4 or 5 years, when we look back at this era of Manchester United, you know, the 11 that was put out on the day, you know how sometimes you see the Liverpool teams from
even when he just took over, to be fair,
and you can't believe the players that were playing. Exactly. It kind of feels like that. I mean, it's impossible to see the likes of, you know, whether it's kind of Rashford up top or Dalot at left wing back or Phil Jones playing in the heart of a midfield three. I don't think Wan-Bissaka's future is at Manchester United either. You know, these are players whose time at the club, whether it's been successful in the past, you know, I'm not writing off Rashford necessarily as a Premier League player, but this team don't look good enough as it is at the moment. You know, Matic playing in centre midfield, who's set to leave at the end of the season despite having another year on his contract. He's made it very clear that he will be departing the club. So whether it's rock bottom, whether it's just a team who've basically given up or the end of the road, whichever kind of idiom you want to come out with, it was a really poor display to be that first goal of Liverpool's. How they were left kind of four on one, or you know, with basically Phil Jones deciding to step out of defence the moment the ball was played over the top by Thiago, was just a side who haven't played very much football together, who aren't particularly well drilled and just don't really know what they're doing. You know, the ball over the top from Thiago was very good. The assist from Mane and the touch from Salah, I think that's one of the most aesthetically pleasing kind of little team goals for the second goal. But it was made incredibly easy for them by a Manchester United side who are desperate. And in Ten Hag, they have someone who everything we know about him suggests that he is going to come in and demand higher standards, but it's easier said than done, and he's going to need help from other people at the club to turn this around rather than it being all down to him.
Yeah, Steve, obviously Manchester United fans, they'll be looking forward to next season, because let's face it, well, let's hope for them, for their sake, it can't get any worse than this season. And George touches on, you know, those Liverpool teams when Klopp first came in or when Brendan Rodgers left. And I agree that, you know, they were bad teams, and obviously 5 years on, Liverpool are now in a sensational place, one of the best teams I've ever seen in my life. But I don't remember those teams being so devoid of effort. That's the thing about Manchester United that I can't get my head round. They don't lay a glove on teams. They just go under in games against teams like Liverpool. It's very easy to get turned over by Liverpool. It will happen to plenty of teams. But in a game of that magnitude, they don't even have someone get booked in the first half. It's not even put a tackle in. I just find it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And the Manchester United fans, I wouldn't know what to do if I was one, because watching that, it would really turn your stomach. And what I say about those other teams have been bad, you know, we had the Chelsea time when fans were having banners about players being rats and things like that. But I don't remember a top team ever being so devoid of any effort or passion.
Yeah, I think, I mean, clearly there's players there coming to the end of their Manchester United career. Obviously, players like Pogba, who, you know, let's remember, started the season with 7 assists in the first month. Has only had a couple since then. Matic, Lingard, you know, Phil Jones, as we've touched on in a five, you know, those players probably won't be there next season as well. It's a team that needs a rebuild. And I think even if you're a fan of Manchester United going to Anfield, there's just a sense of, they just knew that they were going to get beat. You know what I mean? There's just a sense of apathy in the stands as well. From, you know, this used to be a horrible, horrible fixture between two fans that used to absolutely detest, and they still do. But the majority of United fans going there would have been expected to get turned over. And that's, listen, they were 8-1 to win at Anfield. They were 13-5 just the season before. And I thought there was a great line by Daniel Taylor about Rangnick as well, having the air of a supply teacher who's gone for a high five and being left hanging. You know, I thought that was an absolutely fantastic line. Years of mismanagement from the top level all the way down is just biting them on the backside now. And you got a Liverpool side who are just 8-1 to go for the quadruple. And now you have Manchester United, a very unlikely 14-1 to finish in the top four as well this season. And I don't see just where it's going to end. It's a worrying time for Manchester United.
Could certainly be more misery taking on a slightly galvanised Arsenal. But Ralf Rangnick said after the defeat, George, there'll be a rebuild here. 6-7, maybe 10 new players will come. I mean, I don't know how he knows that, because he's not going to be here and he doesn't feel like he's involved in any of the decision making.
Well, he's going to be one of the, you know, he's going to be there as a consultant, isn't he?
I think in name only, he's there.
Yeah, maybe in name only, but I think as far as he's aware, he's going to be involved in the short term future of the club. So I'm sure he is privy to some of the conversations happening now around the playing side rebuild.
But you know, saying that, 6-7, maybe 10 new players will leave, obviously. It's not easy for any manager to just come in and deal with that turnover and an influx of new players. Doing all that, I don't think it necessarily means anything. I don't think it necessarily changed anything, because that club is rotten from the top down.
It is. I mean, what I would say is there have been, you know, we talk a lot about the change of management here, and I am still fully subscribing to the fact that next season Manchester United are going to be in a far better place with Erik ten Hag as a manager than the beginning of this season with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as a manager. That is a massive, massive upgrade, no matter what has happened over the course of this season. But crucially, there have been a lot of changes behind the scenes as well. Ed Woodward is no longer the commander-in-chief of all things transfer at Manchester United. That has to be a massive positive, given he was in a job that he frankly wasn't qualified for. You know, he hadn't had much of a history in terms of player negotiation, player ID, or anything like that. We've also seen this week that two first team scouts are leaving the club as well, which again, when you look at Manchester United's transfer activity, whether it was bringing in an incredibly defensive-minded right-back, as good as he is, in Aaron Wan-Bissaka, or the plenty of other players who've come in, Diego Dalot, Alex Telles, players who frankly just weren't up to the standard needed to improve Manchester United. That has to be a positive as well. What there isn't any guarantee of is that the people who'll be coming into those roles are any better. You know, we're going to see what happens now with Ten Hag's backroom staff. But that is the crucial part for me. You look at the way that Manchester United has been mismanaged from boardroom level downwards, and those people who've been in charge of such a period of malaise are no longer at the club, and that has to be a good thing.
Thinking about Wan-Bissaka, he's come up a couple of times in this pod so far. I think he's going to be another Wilfred Zaha, Dave, because I can't see anywhere else for him to go other than Palace.
Going back.
It's going to be that move again. He's going to go on and have a great career away from being at Manchester United. The same as Zaha. I can see a lot of parallels there.
Well, let's hope he does. It'd be good to see just a player having a miserable time of it at the moment and then going back and getting some form and then, you know, possibly moving on again. But, you know, he'll still have time. But yeah, he's one of many that have been having a disappointed time currently at Manchester United.
Yeah, I did a podcast yesterday with Laurie Whitwell, the United correspondent for The Athletic. He's dubbed them Meme United. I felt sorry for him doing the podcast because we had Kiva on as well. He was representing Liverpool, so it must have been a miserable time for him to be writing about Manchester United and appearing on podcasts. Are either of you at the point yet where you're feeling sorry for Manchester United fans? I feel sorry for Manchester United writers, I must say, at the moment, because they're all good guys. I've worked with all three of them, and I can sense their misery as I read their pieces. But are either of you starting to feel sorry for Meme United?
I feel a bit sorry for the fans who maybe 10 years ago as kids became Manchester United fans and have only really experienced periods.
Nah, they're the ones I don't feel sorry for, the ones that chose Manchester United because they were the best.
Well, no, I mean, we all choose our teams for certain reasons, but mainly it's due to family reasons, so I don't think you can peg them
and
down.
Family,
you know,
the local Manchester boys who... No, I've got no problem with those fans. I feel sorry for those. It's the ones that just chose Manchester United. I know a few of them
chose
Manchester United because they were the best team. I don't feel sorry for them.
I probably shouldn't mention here that I was a Blackburn fan for 6 months in the early 90s before finding Oxford United. But it's...
You ruined them, George, for that 6 months.
On the list of things that I enjoy in football, laughing at other teams' peril is pretty low on my list, maybe apart from Swindon Town at times, because they are actually our rivals. But, you know, you've seen it in the last couple of weeks. You know, on the Manchester United topic, you've seen it with Wayne Rooney in Derby County, where you see a lot of football fans expressing their glee in the kind of demise of a football club, and I'm not particularly happy with that. I think the Premier League is the best possible product, or the best possible league, I should say, product, just shows the state of it all at the moment. The best possible league when all the biggest and best teams are at the very, very, very top. And we had it for a few years where we had, you know, four or five of the best teams in Europe all vying against each other. But at the moment, we've got three. I think you could probably make a case for Chelsea, City and Liverpool being three of probably the best five teams in the world. But, you know, I think, from my point of view as a neutral, Manchester United returning to take on those teams, because frankly, with the infrastructure in place, you can't see any reason why City or Liverpool are going to have their own demise anytime soon.
Steve, what about you?
Yeah, I like watching Manchester United. I think their away fans are fantastic. So
yeah, their away fans are good.
Yeah, but you know, it's a team in decline. Old Trafford is a ground in decline as well. They need to get that sorted out pretty soon as well. So we are 6-4 that they fail to win a trophy next season as well. So we don't see that being turned around anytime soon.
Yeah, and a massive result for Arsenal last night, Steve, after a tough run of three defeats. Crazy game at Stamford Bridge, but a weird game. The standard in that first half was so, so low. And I text our producer, who's obviously an Arsenal fan, saying, Arsenal will find a way to lose this. They'll find a way to chuck this game. But they didn't. Great win at Stamford Bridge.
I wonder why he was bouncing around early in a great mood. It's good to...
He loves it.
It's good to see from a top four race point of view. Arsenal have gone in to 6-5, Dan, from 2-1 after that result against Chelsea as well. And just the way that they did, we'd have lost the right a few quid on just because of the nature of the game. Both teams scoring a number of goals, particularly in the first half as well. But huge game for Saka, of course. Him and Smith Rowe now have 10 Premier League goals between them. Of course, the penalty that Saka took as well.
Nice moment.
Was a sweet, sweet moment for him scoring. And didn't we see that in his celebration as well? The way that he must have had about five different celebrations. It felt like it was about 10 minutes between the time that he scored and the time that they kicked off again. He was just really enjoying it. And, good for him for doing that.
Another man that enjoyed his night, George, Eddie Nketiah. Good to see him tucking away two goals. Probably deserves a chance now to the end of the season, deserves a run in the team, because it must be hard coming on for 10 minutes here and there. When you do get a start, you're probably not starting the next week. They probably need to just put their faith in him a little bit now and give him a run to the end of the season and see how many goals he can score.
I think when someone goes to Stamford Bridge and scores two Premier League goals, it's time to give them a chance, especially when you are a striker short. The circumstances around Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang meant that he was sold in January at a time where they weren't able or willing to bring a replacement in. It was a case of getting him out the door kind of as fast as possible. And Lacazette is clearly, whilst he's got plenty of strengths as a footballer, him dropping deep and turning into a creator led to an improvement in certain players' games, such as Martinelli. But then you look at the game last night and you've got two players in Smith Rowe and Odegaard himself played well, and then Saka scoring the penalty, all kind of thriving as well. So with a striker in Nketiah, who's of course very, very different to Lacazette, he's not someone who's going to drop in a link play. He's going to play off the shoulder. And both goals, I thought, showed exactly what he's about. The first goal, of course, he was helped by Christensen, who played a really weak back pass, but you still saw the pressing from Nketiah to force the mistake, and then the pace he showed and the composure. It would have been very easy for him once getting to that ball to try and take a shot on first. He had the composure to take a touch and to slot it home very well. And for the, it might have looked a bit fortunate given how many ricochets until the ball fell into his path, but he showed a proper poacher's instinct to get his foot on the ball at a time when he was surrounded by a couple of Chelsea defenders and Mendy rushing out to prod the ball past him as well. So two proper goal scorer goals and with a bit of pace to burn, a bit of youthful exuberance and a bit of composure as well. He's had a bit of a stop-start time in his career so far, but off the back of that and the confidence it's going to give him and the fact that there isn't really much in the way of competition, you'd think he's got to get a chance to really make that spot his own and maybe persuade Mikel Arteta and the recruitment team at Arsenal that the going out and spending a lot of money on a striker to replace Aubameyang isn't necessarily needed.
Yeah, and if you're already in Nketiah, Steve, you're probably licking your lips and rubbing your hands at the prospect of coming up against Manchester United's defence.
Oh, yes. Banging confidence, full of it, of course. And I think Arteta kind of admitted it afterwards as well. Just he hasn't been, a lack of courage on his part in not playing him previously as well. So I think it'll be a great time to take advantage of this uncertainty about Manchester United at the moment.
And what's your tip for this game, George?
Shockingly, I am going to be tipping Arsenal to win the game at 21-20. I think anything odds against about them to emerge victorious. As I've said on this pod a few times, I'm not fully sold on Arteta's Arsenal. I think that whilst it was a great result last night and we saw what they're capable of, it's mainly because when you look at the attacking players I have on show on the night, Saka, Smith Rowe, Odegaard, Nketiah, Martinelli off the bench, given United's defensive issues, especially with Pogba having gone off injured again and therefore unlikely to play, it's going to be another poor United side, and I think Arsenal should be licking their lips ahead of this one.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Game two, Brentford v Spurs, the Saturday tea time offering. And George, Brentford are staying up. You watch a lot of them in the EFL. They've done very, very well in their first season back. Feels like there's a chance for them to become Premier League mainstays now and really cement themselves in the league. Just can you contextualise the size of the achievement from the Bees?
Yeah, it's massive. I think people forget because there were probably 3 or 4 years in the Championship where you had every tipster in the country, every stats nerd like myself, tipping them up for promotion. It's easy to forget where they came from. And I'm not talking, you know, 30, 40 years ago. I'm talking about 10 years ago. The prospect of little old Brentford playing in the Premier League in a flashy new stadium was completely not on the cards. Matthew Benham, the owner, I think is basically the perfect owner in terms of being a successful, I was going to say businessman, but I don't know if, I suppose he's a businessman. Professional gambling is its own business, although, maybe not the line of work for everyone. But he's, you know, a local fan, done good, who's invested really sustainably and really smartly into the growth of Brentford Football Club, not just in the playing staff, but building a new stadium, keeping it local. And in terms of whether or not they can stay there, if you compare, let's take Blackpool as an example of a similar sized club who had a similar meteoric rise up to the Premier League, their return back to the EFL, and they went, you know, down pretty far afterwards, was basically inevitable because things weren't in place for them to maintain that level. You know, they were basically running very hot for a short period of time and the demise was always going to come. That isn't the case with Brentford. Everything is in place for them to maintain a Premier League standard football club, in part because they have a massive edge in the transfer market where they're able to recruit Premier League quality players for an absolute snip of the price that you're seeing top level clubs going at it. And that has proven, whether or not you like the way the data is used in football, whether or not that's now becoming saturated because every single football club has data analysts, there's no question that Brentford's recruitment strategy is one step ahead every corner, and we aren't blessed to know why. So often we'll see teams, you know, we've seen it with Leeds this season, we've seen it plenty of times, we saw it with Sheffield United going back down. The second season can often be very, very difficult, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if Brentford do have a difficult campaign next season. But A, if they were to go down, I think they are a side who would bounce back very, very quickly. And B, where they are maybe fortunate this season is that key players who maybe we expected to have incredible seasons, looking at Ivan Toney, Brian Mbeumo, Rico Henry, there hasn't been maybe a standout player who's going to get the likes of Newcastle, you know, all these teams with big money, Aston Villa suddenly throwing down, a 40, 50 million pound bid. As good as Ivan Toney has been, and he's got double figure goals for the season, I don't think he's on anyone's radar to go out and sign him this summer. So being able to keep that key group of players together, I think is going to be a big benefit to them ahead of next season. And I'm sure we'll see at least 4 or 5 come in the door as well.
Yeah, I mean, one man that has completely added to them, Steve, is Christian Eriksen. They were looking like they might go down. I think we speculated that they were going to be the ones that would potentially fall into trouble. But Christian Eriksen's come in, made a massive impact. Do you think Brentford can keep him beyond the end of the season?
Let's start with relegation first. I mean, Brentford were third favs at the start of the season and they were 10-1 for relegation at Christmas. But you're right, the next 11 games, they lost 9 of those. They only won one game. I'll mention that because that was against Aston Villa. So they were into 6-4 for...
Doesn't shock me.
They were into 6-4 for relegation and 50-1 for the top half. They're 4-1 for that now. And of course, Eriksen has played a big part. He started 5 games and they've won all the 5 games. A real feel-good story. Brentford, I mean, do you look at it two ways? Me personally, Brentford have taken a bit of a chance on him, I suppose, and you'd be hoping that he repays them by staying put when this 6-month contract comes to an end. But if you're Eriksen, and of course living in London as well would be I'd imagine a bonus for his family. I suppose his family are settled there. But then I suppose you've got the lure of Spurs, who, and he thinks, well, I want to get the maximum out of my career. Again, after what happened, and
worked under Conte before as well.
Yeah, that's another angle as well. It's a difficult one. Of course, he wasn't allowed to play in Italy with his with the heart device that he has now. We've seen him really flourish here, and I think everyone's delighted to see that. And you know, Brentford are he's done absolutely fantastically well for Brentford.
I think we also, given the circumstances, we don't know what happened with the process of him signing in the first place. And given that Brentford don't have an option on the contract, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this is a very amicable parting of ways, where the conversation to start with was, you know, play for us for 6 months, we'll put you in the shop window. If everything's healthy, we can have a chat at the end of it. But, you know, we won't begrudge you at all if you want to move on. It's certainly a move that's benefited Brentford massively. And I think to an extent put them on the map for other elite players to know this is a place you can go and enjoy your football.
It would be good to see him stay there because he has galvanised him. I think they've both been good for each other. So we'll see what happens with him. But overall, Steve, good to see Brentford not become one of those yo-yo teams that you know so much about.
Very good. You couldn't resist that dig. It's been...
I've been trying to get it in the heart for the whole last 5 minutes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, George mentioned Ivan Toney there. I thought Newcastle might come in for him again, a return there. And there's one...
Potentially.
And there's one player...
They've probably got bigger fish to fry, I would say, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, and there's one player that I love. Well, I didn't when he let a couple of goals in against Wigan three or four years ago. David Raya, of course, now who's a Spanish international, 26, modern-day goalkeeper, got a lot going forward as well. They might do well to keep hold of him as well, Brentford. But yeah, bit of a success story for sure so far.
It'll be a similar story to Brighton, though, where... If someone comes in for David Raya, if someone comes in for Ivan Toney, Matthew Benham will say, yeah, absolutely. You know, he's available. This is the price. And it'll be much more than what teams think it's going to be. And they'll say, well, you know, either pay the price or go away.
Well, they've been very good at shifting players for huge profits for a number of years. Yeah. They've done it in the Championship a number of times. I mean, my team, Villa, have bought three or four players off them in the last four or five seasons and spent an awful lot of money.
And they often don't kick on either.
Oh, we've had a couple that have done okay, but yeah.
I know, of course. The record in terms of selling the right players for the right cash at the right time has been very impressive.
Really well-run club, Brentford. Well done to them for staying up. That sounded very patronising, but I didn't mean for it to be at all. Now, across this podcast network, and in particular on this feed, we've spent a lot of time in the last week or so talking about how Spurs have become a more consistent outfit. So, of course, Steve, on Saturday, they decided to go and lose 1-0 late at home to Brighton without registering a shot on target. This top four race... there's no point saying anything about teams anymore because nobody wants it. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, one of the best results of the weekend for ourselves. It was a good shot, well received by us. We didn't win this weekend in the Premier League, by the way. It was a losing weekend, but that certainly helped. To all the highs, people were just expecting to limit Kane just to one shot. Son to a couple of shots as well. I think it was a fantastic performance by Brighton. Unfortunately for us, they couldn't do it against Manchester City just a few days later, but that's probably asking just a little bit too much. But yeah, Spurs are still favourites to finish in that top four spot, but it's certainly made it more interesting again.
Yeah, Oliver Skipp's got a new contract, doubling his wages and keeping him at the club until 2027, George. Is he good enough for the level Spurs and Conte are trying to reach? Is he a Champions League player, Oliver Skipp?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not going to sit here and say that he's going to be one of the elite players in the world in his position, but I think often the obsession now in modern day football with transfers and players has almost translated into this idea that every single player in your squad has to be, you know, an 8 out of 10, a 9 out of 10 player. And you forget that actually a lot of the best teams in the history of the Premier League have had players who maybe don't do anything particularly flashy, who maybe aren't the most talented footballers, but in terms of what they offer to the side itself, and Skip is someone who is very, very combative in midfield. He's a very competent passer, and he's somebody who has only played just under a season's worth of Premier League football at this stage in his career, in a position where I think you develop very, very fast in terms of games played. So I think he's a quality asset for them to have. I think every squad needs an Oliver Skipp, someone who's dependable in the middle of the park and can play that role very well. And it's handy that in Højbjerg as well. I know his star has fallen a little bit this season with some Spurs fans, but he's able to play alongside him and enable Højbjerg to use his more creative talents that we haven't necessarily seen as much in the course of his Spurs career. So I'm not sitting here saying it's a brilliant signing, but I do think that all squads need these guys who are dependable and aren't going to throw their toys out the pram if they play 20 starts a season rather than 38 as well. So a smart bit of business, if maybe not a flashy one.
Definitely. And I think having seen him earlier in the season, I was very impressed. And it also gives other youngsters hope coming through. I mean, he looks... I had to check his age. He is 21, I suppose... Clearly, I can't throw stones in that department. But, you know, maybe because he's been at Spurs since he's 5 years old. But, yeah, it certainly gives youngsters hope as well. And you know what? Conte is a fan, quite clearly, of him. And I think he's a little bit frustrated with the Spurs physio staff, the medical team, that he's not back fit and firing, to be honest with you. Really pleasing for Skip. And let's hope he kicks on and has a very, very good career, which I'm sure he will.
Yeah, and just quickly, Charlie Eccleshare and some of our Athletic colleagues have put together a piece which marked the 1 year anniversary of Jose Mourinho getting the sack. Feels like a lifetime ago, that, to be honest. A lot's happened since then. Both agree that's probably the right decision. I mean, the fact they've ended up with Conte and where they are now, you've probably got to say they're better off with Conte than they would have been with Mourinho. That would be my opinion. But both of you, right decision?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, cast your minds back. Last season when they were beating City 2-0, they were at the top of the Premier League for the first time since August 2014. They drew with Chelsea, they beat Arsenal 2-0. They were proudly top of the Premier League. Jose was talking all the title chances down, and he was right too. They finished seventh. So, yeah.
George, agree?
Yeah, it has to have been the right decision. I know that things at Roma haven't been quite as... it looked like we were going to have a very short Jose arc with a fast start and then a massive drop-off, and things have steadied a little bit, but... that there's no evidence to suggest that Mourinho is still an elite level manager. And in Antonio Conte, they have a manager who, apart from probably four teams in Europe, every single other club would love to have, I think probably including Manchester United now as well. So, you've got to say it was the correct decision, even if the interim appointment between the two, which wasn't meant to be an interim appointment in Nuno, probably didn't justify it initially.
It's probably made that appointment for Conte even better, the interim appointment of Nuno. Steve, what's your tip for this one? Which centre-half are you backing?
Well, I'll tell you what, I should have gone for Pinnock and Janssen, shouldn't I? Because they've had about 40 shots between them. I think Pinnock might be injured for this one. I am going to go for a bit of romance. A boosted bet builder, Brentford to win, Ericsson to score any time, and both teams to score. So that's from 22-1 out to 28-1. So yeah, Ericsson to score any time would be the interesting one, obviously.
Yeah, I quite like the sound of that, Steve. Not a bad shout at all. Game three is Chelsea v West Ham, Stamford Bridge, 2 p.m. on Sunday. George, Romelu Lukaku, he says almost invisible in the first half. Almost invisible for the entire season, unless he's playing against Aston Villa Football Club, where he scored three goals. But what is going on? They're just from nowhere back in the team. Doesn't really do anything. Doesn't fit with Chelsea at all, which I don't think any of us particularly saw coming in the summer when they signed him. I think we were all waxing lyrical about that signing. Mm. They're going to have to just cut their losses in the summer, aren't they? Especially if Tuchel stays.
Yeah, I can't see why Lukaku and Tuchel would still be at Chelsea next season, and I can't see why Tuchel won't be there. So it's going to be for whoever the new owner is, having an asset that costs so much money, that is costing the club so much money in terms of wages, where you're going to have to get rid of him at a cut price on both fronts. I can't imagine they're going to find any club willing to cover the wages. So I'm sure Chelsea will be paying for this transfer for a few years to come. But they're... it just seems like a totally wrong fit. And this is often where clubs could really fall short. I'd be amazed, given the way that Thomas Tuchel sets up his team, given the recruitment previously in terms of bringing in Havertz, it doesn't seem like there was any joined up thinking here. I'd be amazed if Tuchel was the person saying, go and get me Romelu Lukaku. And that is the way that football clubs should work. You should have a manager who isn't himself necessarily the one identifying the players, but it's certainly telling those whose job it is to identify players what he wants. And that wasn't the case. Normally you can get away with it, but when you're spending the kind of fees that Chelsea are for Lukaku, it's pretty costly. So I was in the camp where I thought he was going to be the missing piece of the puzzle, but that clearly isn't the case. I think he would still be a superb striker for a lot of clubs, but the way that Chelsea play just doesn't suit him at all.
Where would he go next, Steve? Lukaku back to Inter? I mean, I'm sure would you swap him for Andy Carroll at West Brom? I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'd take Romelu back, yeah, after what he did for us the first time around. The way Villa are losing matches as well, I suppose you'd probably take him as well. In all honesty,
I might think about it.
Yeah,
I might think about
it. Listen, only one of our clubs could afford it, and it's certainly at the Albion, mate. But yeah, just the way that he's been playing, was it 20 odd touches at least? He had more than recent games. Timo Werner now looks more of a threat in front of goal. And who'd have thought that at the start of the season? No Premier League goal for him in 2022. I wouldn't be surprised to see him move back aboard, but we'll have to see what happens. I hope, as a previous player, I hope he can start firing again, because it must be a frustrating time for him.
He's always someone I've enjoyed watching, always found him to be fun to watch. I think he's a sensational player, Lukaku, but just not worth it at Chelsea at all. But I do feel he's in a bit of trouble here. I'm not sure where he goes, because I'm not sure Inter have got the money that Chelsea will demand, unless they write him off and loan him out for a couple of years like they've done with players previously.
I just don't think Chelsea are in the negotiating position here. They can demand whatever they want, but no one's going to pay it. And so that then eventually it becomes what people are willing to pay for him rather than what they want. I mean, the only other thing I'd say about Lukaku is that he, you know, his performances outside of the penalty area or in terms of doing anything apart from scoring goals have been very, very poor. He has been atrocious in front of goal to a level that just will not continue. You know, even you saw him coming off in the Palace game and poking the ball against the post in what was such an easy opportunity. Those chances will start going in, and that will only serve to paper over the cracks, because whilst him scoring, let's say, 4, 5, 6 more goals this season wouldn't have made a massive difference, it certainly would look better in terms of what he'd done in this campaign. But he's just a bad fit for this club.
Newcastle, maybe. I'm trying to think of teams. Could Newcastle take a punt? That could be one, couldn't it? West Ham, potentially.
Not Villa, Dan.
Trying to think of...
The best place for him to go, which wouldn't happen. I mean, I'm not touting this at all, would be for Harry Kane to leave Spurs and him going to play under Conte at Spurs. Like, that would make the most sense. Because, well, you know, that is... Like, Romelu Lukaku under Antonio Conte was one of the best strikers in the world.
That's what I'm saying. I loved watching him at Inter. Yeah. Absolutely adored watching him at Inter. Harry Kane... I think, I mean, I'm really getting away from what we're supposed to be doing here, but I'm sure it's fine. No one on mine. Obviously, Haaland looks like he's going to Manchester City now, so Kane isn't going to Manchester City. If Manchester United are buying 10 players, I don't think they're splashing 100 million plus on Harry Kane. So he's probably going to be at Spurs next season.
I think he wants to be as well.
Yeah. If I was Harry Kane, I'd be thinking stay at Spurs, don't go to Manchester United. And there isn't just obvious places for strikers at the moment. So Lukaku could well end up at somewhere like Newcastle. That would be a statement signing for them. And I guess that's what they're looking for. But yeah, let's move away from that, because we're not here to talk about transfer speculation, Steve. I don't know. I was blaming you. I was just coming to you next, Steve. It was clearly me that started that. Chelsea, no defence at the moment at all. 11 goals conceded in their last 3 at Stamford Bridge, and Tuchel's keen to blame the pitch, but, you know, Rudiger's future's up in the air. Thiago Silva's 37. Saar had a tough night last night against Arsenal. Chelsea's centre-back position kind of felt like a position of strength at one point, but now it kind of feels like they might need to do some business on their defence in the summer.
Big time, you would say, but they're kind of bookmaker friendly at home, you would say, Chelsea, with the drop points that they've had against, like, Brentford. They were 2-5 to beat Brentford, 3-on to beat Brighton, 1-4 to beat Everton. Christensen looks to be away. Like you say, Saar was shaky. Reece James, he's clearly better out wide. And I think they've probably missed the two wing-backs, really, Chilwell and James, together as a pair. They haven't started a great deal.
That was when they were going well, wasn't it? You know, yeah.
The games when they were playing, they'd won all those games, they'd scored 14 goals. Aspilicueta losing his rag last night. You know, what's...
Yeah, the whole thing's just weird, isn't it? It was a weird atmosphere at Stamford Bridge last night. I don't know whether it's the empty seats and only season ticket holders being allowed to be there, but it just felt a very strange atmosphere at Stamford Bridge last night, especially for a big London derby as well. But, yeah, they're in an FA Cup final, you know, was the third.
Yeah.
It's not like they're having a horrific season,
is it?
It's
the uncertainty of, I suppose, where the club's going as well. And just all the players just seem to be off it. And N'Golo Conte as well. I mean, is he in bad form? No, he doesn't seem to. He's never normally
certainly
out of form.
Himself.
But yeah, maybe just performing normally like a 7 out of 10 instead of like the 9 out of 10 we're normally used to seeing them as well.
But this is kind of what I touched on a few weeks ago when we did a FA Cup preview here, is that, you know, when it gets to cup final day, of course Chelsea fans are going to want to win. But realistically, the FA Cup for Chelsea fans, so what else is new? You know, they've won it plenty of times. It's not a massive barometer of success. It's great to win a trophy. But for, you know, I can understand why some Chelsea fans will feel like their luck is out. You know, they came into this season second favourites to win the league ahead of Liverpool. Let's remember that. They came into this season European champions, and they're out of the Champions League off the back of an incredibly unjust result over two legs. And, you know, the players will feel that. The players will know that they didn't deserve to go out, as will the fans. They're their sugar daddy, their owner who's brought them all the success, is no longer, and they're waiting to find out. They can't go to games unless they've got a season ticket. I think it's just a bit of a petulance around what will feel, you know, it's like when you've had a bet and you watch the game and you know your team's been better than the other team and you're annoyed afterwards. It's just like that. I think they just feel like, you know, when are we going to get a break, basically? I personally don't feel too sorry for them, given the success that those fans have seen and the players have had over the last few years.
Well, I'll tell you what, a set of fans I am envious of at the moment, West Ham. They've got the Europa League hangover. They've had a 1-1 draw with Burnley last time out. But it's supposed to be great to be on that European adventure. It's like uncharted territory. I'd kill for something like this as a Villa fan. You know, they've got a great chance of winning the Europa League. But is their success been a little bit overplayed, Steve? You know, their wage bill's a lot higher than Lyon's. So really, it shouldn't be a massive surprise that they've beaten them. I know they're not regulars in Europe and Lyon probably are, but, you know, I'd look at that West Ham side and would have said straight away from the knockouts, they've got a good chance of winning this. But as a fan, it must be brilliant.
Yeah, I think they've only ever been 10, 12 to 1, the biggest price that they've been to do the Europa League. Yeah, their top six challenge, I mean, they're still 130 to do that. That's petered away just a little bit as well. But if you're a fan, these are the type of games that you want to be in a Europa League, and they've certainly got a chance of winning it as well. And they'll love, I think, going to Chelsea and having a chance of ruffing a few feathers here. The fans will certainly be up for it. I know ex players will. I normally get a text from or a WhatsApp from Jimmy Walker, ex Walsall goalie, who saved Frank Lampard's penalty in front of the West Ham fans in about 2004. He always sends a reminder. I guarantee you, he'll be doing it again this weekend.
I've got a sneaky feeling for West Ham at the weekend at Stamford Bridge. Obviously some difficult days at Stamford Bridge in the last few home games. George, with that in mind, what is your tip? Is it anything to do with that?
Yeah, I've got one that I really like here. I hope Steve is going to get on the traders WhatsApp group after this and change it. Jared Bowen's 5-1 to score at any time in this game. And when you consider that he's scored 10 goals in his last 16 games in all competitions, when you think of Chelsea's defensive insecurities, instability at the moment, the poor home form, conceding 4 against Arsenal at home, conceding 4 against Brentford at home, you've got to fancy West Ham to, you know, even if they don't win the game, give Chelsea a bit of a shock. And given West Ham's defensive frailties as well, their best way of getting ahead of here is by going forward. I think Bowen is clearly West Ham's biggest goal threat, and for him to be 14-1 first and last and 5-1 anytime is a massive price.
How about this one then, Georgie boy? Bowen to score anytime. Match result to be draw or West Ham. Over 2 goals in the match. 20-1.
Yeah,
boosted. Yeah, boosted just for you, Georgie. Just for you.
Just for me. Okay.
16s to 20s. Yeah, how about that?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Max bet?
Fiver.
Okay, but done.
Game 4 then is the Merseyside derby. It's Liverpool v Everton, 4:30 kickoff on Sunday. And let's start, George, by talking about Thiago. Oh my God.
Yes, please.
What a player. Not a difficult time last season, but didn't settle in perhaps as quickly as you would expect an established player like him to do. But my God, he's made up for it this time round. Such a good player. He just does everything well.
It's really strange how long it's taken. You know, if you remember the kind of the circus around his signing, it was rightly as if Liverpool were signing one of the elite players in Europe. And then it went pretty quiet. You know, we saw some flashes of brilliance. He was in and out of the side. He was obviously injured very early in the campaign.
He loved a yellow card last season. Loved a yellow card.
Oh, he always has. In my opinion, he gets away with more from referees than any player. I think it's because he's seen as being... It was the same with David Silva back in the day. Because they're seen as being these mercurial, gifted, ball-playing midfielders, the dirty side sometimes gets a bit unpunished. But he is... I mean, he's one of the best at doing what he does that we've seen. His passing range, his vision is absolutely brilliant. And the fact is that he's also can do that job defensively as well on one side of the three. He's a joy to watch. And as I say, having watched him a lot and having been so excited by his arrival at Liverpool, the only surprise is that it's taken to now until we're seeing him consistently week in, week out, put in performances that are changing games, are winning games and dominating games.
Player of the season odds next year.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that him taking his time. When he first joined in September 2020, I remember we made him favourite. Like other firms were like 33s, 50s, a massive price. And we when I speak to the lads, we were probably sitting up thinking, oh, you know, what a player is, if he can hit the ground running. And like we say, it's taken him a while to do that. He, next season, I would say, the form he's in now will be fresh in people's minds. Clearly, he's very unlikely to win it this season. But next season, for me, he will be a single-figure prize in the PFA Player of the Year Award, definitely.
Yeah, so much in his armoury. The way he passes the ball is just an absolute joke. Sadio Mane, right wing, left wing, through the middle, Steve. He's just fantastic for Liverpool. Is he one of the most versatile elite forwards there's ever been? And is he currently one of the most versatile and elite forwards in European football?
He's a joy to watch, isn't he? He even got a rare assist against Manchester United, but not a rare goal. So he's got 7 in the last 10. He's obviously a big player for club and country. But what he does consistently and what he's done in every single season since he's been in the Premier League, and let's remember he's had a couple of seasons at Southampton as well, he just hits double figures every season. And you know, his form in front of goal, it's fantastic. I don't know how long he's got left at the... or how long he will be at Liverpool, but he's very, very enjoyable to watch. And as are Liverpool this season, and you know, Everton fans must be fearing the worst for this weekend.
I imagine that Everton fans will be feeling a little bit like Manchester United fans felt going into the game on Tuesday, but it was a big equalising goal from Richarlison in stoppage time to rescue a point against Leicester midweek, George. We're recording before Burnley and Southampton have played. Burnley's decision to sack Sean Dyche earlier in the week, does that change the way you see the relegation picture?
I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, for all the respect that Sean Dyche rightfully has, since we recorded last week, I have read some interesting pieces basically saying that, you know, if you compare the Burnley to 2 or 3 years ago compared to the Burnley now, there has been a massive drop off in terms of results themselves and how many games he's won. Does he deserve to be able to take Burnley down? Possibly, but in this game where survival is worth so much to a club, you can't begrudge them maybe just rolling the dice and seeing if a change can help. They obviously got a very good point off the back of that against West Ham. You know, they were probably fairly fortunate to get that point with West Ham battering them in the second half, but couldn't get the winner. But that was a big point. So possibly, I think that Richarlison goal on Wednesday evening was huge in terms of just keeping Everton in the better position of the two to go and achieve promotion. But what you can be sure of, in my mind, is that Everton are not playing well. And under Frank Lampard, there's been enough now to see that they're going to struggle to go on the kind of run that could see them clear. So Burnley still very much in it. But I'm not going to sit here and say that without Dyche in the short term, they're going to drop off. But there's also no reason to think there's going to be a sharp uptick either.
I'm not sure I agree with everything there. I think that was a big win for Everton, Dyche getting the sack, Steve, especially when you think, you know, and Everton had this problem. You've sacked your manager, but you haven't got anyone lined up.
That was the thing.
Burnley feels the same. Who is going there as manager?
Maybe
it could just end up being the caretaker that stays.
Maybe they had someone lined up and it's fallen down, and hence why Georgie's mate is currently top of the list as replacements without Chris Wilder. Obviously, he has been strongly linked in recent days with that, and he hasn't been saying a great deal in his press conferences at Borough either. So, huge goal for them. They're still Everton on Wednesday night, and of course Burnley are still rock solid favourites to do that before the game against Southampton. So it's still very much looks like Burnley will go down. But like you, Dan, I am quite surprised that no one's been put in place. But we don't know the ins and outs of it, do we?
No. Everton obviously won at Liverpool last season, no fans, but that feels a lifetime ago as well. I'm presuming you don't fancy Everton here, Steve.
No, a massive price. And I feel sorry for the fans. I don't think the fans were in at Anfield, were they, to see?
Nah.
Oh, so what a blow for them. And of course, Liverpool going for the quad. We've talked about this previously. They have been 1,500-1 for the quad. They're now into 8-1. I think we'll lose about 3 million on it if they do cop it. But as regards to my bet, Liverpool have Villarreal in midweek, so I can see them wanting to get off to a flyer and maybe rest some of those tired legs. So I'm going to go the half to have most goals being the first half at 2-1.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Game 5 is Crystal Palace v Leeds, 8pm on Monday night. Crystal Palace, Monday night club. Always playing a Monday, never any other day for them in the Premier League nowadays, it feels like. Palace have been on a bit of a come down since the Wembley defeat at the weekend. We asked our correspondent Matt Woosnam what the last week has been like for the club.
The defeat against Chelsea, I don't think anyone expected Palace to win that game, but there was a lot of anticipation beforehand. This is a young, vibrant, attacking team that has played progressive football all throughout the season for the most part, but Patrick Vieira changed things around to try to match Chelsea. It worked in the first half, it probably worked for the first sort of 50 minutes or so, but then Chelsea got their breakthrough and that was that. That anticipation that had arisen before the game, things felt a bit flat. You know, what do Palace have to play for now? And they will play for pride, but I suppose what else is there to galvanise this team? And this is where Patrick Vieira's man management has to come in. It was always going to be difficult against Newcastle United, having won 5 games on the bounce at home. But Palace never really got going against Newcastle either. Patrick Vieira was clearly very unhappy with the refereeing performance from Tony Harrington, who I think it was only his second Premier League fixture. He perceived him to be poor in stopping Newcastle's time wasting and rotational fouling. He threw his water bottle down several times in the first half. He was clearly frustrated and angry at some of the moves from his players, and at full time he went over to the referee and almost slapped his hand rather than shook it. Clearly again angry at the situation, and Jeffrey Schlupp next to him had to calm him down. A record Premier League points haul is probably not going to happen now. They would need 4 wins from their last 6 games, which feels insurmountable. But this is where Vieira and his coaching staff will have to find a way to bring the best out of these players and motivate them for the rest of the season. They will still want to finish as high as possible, and Vieira will demand that of them. But now is probably the biggest test of Vieira at Palace so far.
Yeah, I suppose you're going to be on a downer, aren't you, after 3 defeats on the bounce, one of them being an FA Cup semi-final in a competition that you've never won. But I want to look at the positives, really. They're still comfortably above the relegation zone, where many were expecting them to be in that relegation zone after the appointments of Vieira. We had them as fourth favourites of relegation at the start of the season. And yeah, I know defeats have taken some gloss off their season so far, where they've taken some big scalps. I'm not writing the season off just yet either. Only 5-2, Dan, to finish in the top half. So you've got some real dead rubbers coming up. Leeds, Southampton, your boys as well. Watford might be down there as well, down and out, and a dead rubber for them as well. So yeah, I think some huge positives for Patrick Vieira.
Yeah, and one team that did roll the dice on the manager, George, Leeds. It was a bold decision to sack Bielsa, although they were looking in worlds of trouble, looking like they were going to concede 100 goals every game. But, you know, Jesse Marsh has come in. He's not low-key at all, is he? But I think what he's done there has gone down quite low-key. You know, they're suddenly unbeaten in 4 games. He's talking about, you know, Bielsa's training methods perhaps contributing to Leeds' injury crisis. But that managerial shift and that change, that shows how it can work, because Leeds were looking in a lot of trouble.
They were. And I think the key thing he's changed, that they aren't much better defensively, even if they aren't necessarily conceding as many goals. You know, if you look at the expected goals for the last few games, even in the Watford 3-0 win, it was 1.07, 0.9. In the 1-0 against Southampton, they still conceded 2.06 to their own 1.51. Conceded two against Wolves, conceded against Norwich. But they're now a good goal-scoring team. They're now a good attacking force again. And that's what's been so important, is the games are still pretty frantic and full of full of chances, but under the end of Bielsa's reign, they were frantic, full of chances, and all the chances were going to the opposition. Calvin Phillips came off the bench against Watford, which is a massive plus. You'd think he's probably going to start here, and that I think alone could see them being a far more solid outfit and could see the flow of goals stemmed. So positive times to be a Leeds fan, or more positive now, even if they haven't necessarily quite bought into the cult of personality around Jesse March as of yet, as was the case with Marcelo Bielsa.
They'd have taken being in this position a few months ago, that's for certain. They definitely would have taken, because they're almost safe. And I think they will have a good end to the season. So I think, yeah, you're right. Positive times for Leeds. Steve, both these teams looking ahead to next season. Have we got any early odds on them and where they're going to finish, or where they're expected to finish?
Yeah, nothing concrete, just tissue prices really, Dan. But I see them both being around the similar price to be relegated. Obviously, the three teams that come up will be the first three favourites, but they won't be that far behind, probably around 3-1-ish, I would say. So we're still, I suppose, if you're a fan of both clubs, saying we're a little bit disrespectful again. But, you know, Leeds are currently, before the game tonight, still 10-1 to go down. So they are slightly still in the relegation mix, but I'm extremely hopeful of Leeds, because you know what a fan I am of Marsh. So hopefully they'll be able to push on and have a decent next season.
And with more clever recruitment as well, I'd back Palace to have a good season next season. I think they've done what's expected. Well, I think they've exceeded expectations in a lot of ways, especially when you look at the playing style this season. I'd expect them to push on again with more smart business next season. So yeah, be interesting to see how both those clubs build in the summer. George, where's the smart money for this one?
It's Leeds, and I think when Leeds are playing, it's got to be goals. I'm going over 2.5 goals, or over 2 goals in the game, and both teams to score at even money. As I say, Phillips might make them a bit more solid, but this is a game with very little to play for either team, and often at this stage of the season, games like that can end up being pretty entertaining. So yeah, even money, about over 2.5 in BTTS.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, George. Just enough time for me to remind you to subscribe to The Athletic today and gain full access to all the brilliant articles and ad-free podcasts for just £1 a month for the first 6 months by visiting theathletic.com/footballpod. My thanks go to George and Steve, as always, and of course, all of you for listening. Please do remember to rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribers to The Athletic and Apple Plus should also keep an eye out for the new bite-sized Ornstein on Monday podcast that's available every Monday lunchtime on this feed. Mark Chapman and the main pod available as per usual from Monday evening. You've been listening to The Athletic Football Podcast. Have a great weekend and enjoy all the football.
The Athletic.